Hello all, and welcome to today's edition of The Forum, presented by the Institute on Science for Global Policy. I'm Cleo, and my co-hosts are Aubrey and Barbara. Remember that if anything strikes you as interesting in our talk today, you can let us know on Twitter using the Forum's very own shiny new account.
Or check us out on Facebook. That page is shiny and new as well.
That's right. We're taking over social media, people. Tweet us at ISGPForum with hashtag ISGPForum. And to like us on Facebook, go to the page ISGP's The Forum. Today we'll be discussing a paper from the ISGP's IAP program, one that falls within our larger conference theme of FSSD. Now, that's more acronyms than anyone is comfortable with, so let's break that down for you.
Okay, let's start with ISGP, which is the Institute on Science for Global Policy, essentially the head honcho for this podcast, which I'm guessing you all know by now. IAP stands for ISGP Academic Partnership, which is one of the conference series the ISGP holds that is directed towards college students and incorporated into a semester-long class. Finally, FSSD stands for Food Safety, Security, and Defense, which defines one of several ISGP signature series, which is a fancy way of saying it's a broad theme that's super important at the moment within the science and society interface.
Thank you for all the decoding, Aubrey. To be honest, even we still get lost in the sea of acronyms at times. So, back to the paper. This FSSD conference was titled Safeguarding the American Food Supply, and it took place at Ursinus College in Collegeville, Pennsylvania, which, Aubrey, our very own Ursinus grad, assures us is a real place.
It is. Ugh, I'm going to have to take you guys up there sometime to settle this.
Until then, Collegeville is a mythical place that belongs in a family sitcom or a comic book. Anyway, the conference in question took place on April 11th through 12th, 2015. One presenter at this conference was Dr. Karen Everstein, a research associate from the National Center for Food Protection and Defense at the University of Minnesota. Sounds like a perfect fit for a food safety and security conference.
She sure was. Dr. Everstein presented on her paper titled Policies to Proactively Address the Threat of Food Fraud, and she forced all of us, staff, debaters, and audience members alike, to think more critically about our food system, as well as the many, sometimes daunting ways in which it can be tampered with.
And this paper, by the way, can be found on the ISGP website under the Publications tab. So, food fraud. What exactly does this mean? Is this like black market exchanges of banned food products? Or maybe it's mistaking Velveeta for liquid gold? I think we need some definitions here. Well, Dr. Everstein gives us a good starting point when she defines food fraud as the intentional misinterpretation of food products or ingredients for economic gain. The FDA prefers to refer to it as EMA, or economically motivated adulteration. And while it's not intended to cause illness among consumers, food fraud can and has resulted in illness and even death in the past.
That's right, Barb. There have been adverse health effects, but the main reason companies or individuals commit food fraud is to make more money. They'll replace a more expensive ingredient with a cheaper alternative. And all the while, you as the consumer think you're buying the legit, more expensive version.
For this reason, it's not surprising that food fraud has caused considerable economic losses to industry. It takes a lot of money and resources to put together the public health response needed to clean up these issues.
So, as strange or trivial as food fraud may seem to some people in the grand scheme of international issues in today's world, it's a serious challenge that affects anyone who purchases food, not to mention that it's a public health issue affecting all taxpayers.
Exactly, and Dr. Everstein suggested in her paper that it's about time we created policies that foster innovative and multidisciplinary solutions for food protection. Let's start by covering some of the current realities of this situation. Food fraud can occur through a number of methods, intentional or unintentional, and can be very difficult to track and prevent. One of these methods includes the substitution of one ingredient for another.
Such as claiming that a fillet at the grocery store is tilapia, when really it's some other cheaper whitefish. This was a huge point of interest for students during the Ursinus conference, since one of our biology classes actually examines fish from local restaurants in the lab to see whether the fish you're eating is actually the type of fish you ordered off the menu. In a lot of cases, they're two completely different species. Talk about food fraud. But I digress.
Anyway, the dilution of products such as oils or juices with cheaper ingredients is another common form of food fraud. A current example of this that has been on the news is the discovery that some companies that produce lower-cost honey are diluting it with other sugary syrups.
My honey isn't actually honey. Now what will I put in my tea?
There's more than that. In addition to dilution, the improper identification of a product's country of origin, harvesting, or processing techniques all fall under this category as well.
Sounds like there are a lot of ways we can be deceived as consumers.
Definitely. And with multiple large-scale food fraud incidents occurring over the past 10 years, Dr. Everstein believes we can no longer assume any of our current food supply chains are completely protected.
Which is definitely not a settling thought, especially when we consider the fact that we really don't know the true scope of food fraud. And it's not just uncertainty on the part of the average consumer, because the experts aren't sure either. Many believe that documented incidents are merely the tip of the iceberg, and that the majority of cases go undetected or unreported.
Now, we don't want to scare everyone into starvation. Most food fraud incidences don't actually cause illness or death, as the perpetrator's goals is to avoid detection and to continue the practice.
Right, because if an entire population gets sick from an adulterated product, the distributing company is going to come under serious scrutiny and won't be able to profit from their devious actions any longer.
Mistakes do, unfortunately, get made, though, and illness isn't completely off the table.
Examples of some major mistakes include the 1981 sale of industrial rapeseed oil denatured with the chemical aniline, which was masquerading about in the marketplace as olive oil. Why was it a mistake on behalf of the distributor? Well, this seemingly simple and sly switch was responsible for 20,000 illnesses and over 300 deaths in Spain.
300 deaths? Who would have thought an oil switch could be so lethal?
And that wasn't the only incident. In 2008, 300,000 illnesses and at least 6 infant deaths were attributed to the adulteration of milk supplies in China. In general, food fraud isn't really considered a top priority in food safety, but as the food supply continues to globalize, we should be more concerned about food protection.
And as if the tragedies of death and illnesses aren't enough, food fraud is an expensive issue.
Definitely. Food fraud requires a significant amount of money and resources to remedy, even if incidents don't cause consumer illness. For example, may we remind you of the horsemeat adulteration incident of 2013 in the European Union?
That was actually real? I could have sworn that was urban myth territory.
Unfortunately not. In this incident, food labeled as containing beef was found to actually have undeclared horsemeat, as much as 100% of the meat content in some cases.
Well, there go my plans for getting a burger for lunch.
No, no, no. Don't let us ruin your plans. Though our debaters did see this dilution of high-cost products with lower-cost ingredients as the most prevalent form of food fraud...
It's fine. Don't worry. I'll make my body happier and get a nice organic salad.
Well, you might not want to hear this, but the false labeling of food products as organic or free range is also super prevalent in the conversation of food fraud.
Ugh, I can't win today.
So my organic free range chickens might actually have been cooped up in tiny dirt cages their whole lives?
Well, you have to be really careful about trusting or interpreting these labels. And it gets even worse because food fraud also results in control and oversight problems within the supply chain, hindering the traceability of products and undermining consumers' abilities to make informed food choices.
The debaters really harped on this topic because limited traceability doesn't only make it hard for consumers, but it also impedes regulatory actions at the governmental organization levels, like within the FDA.
What's the big deal about traceability?
Well, without the ability to trace the ingredients of a product back to their source, we're sort of blind to as where the food comes from and what's happening to it on the way to our grocery stores. Investigators of food fraud sometimes feel legally hampered when they don't want to reach a premature conclusion in the investigation or implicate any wrongdoers when they can't accurately trace a product to its source,
making culprit catching a painstakingly difficult and often fruitless process.
Yeah, unfortunately, no one is held fully accountable for incidents of food fraud most of the time.
I feel like I'll never be able to trust my olive oil to be true and faithful to me. Let's take a turn toward the optimistic. What's happening to remedy this situation and what's actually working?
Well, sometimes it's hard to say. Regulations vary from country to country, and it's difficult to name one system as better than another. Some proposed measures of success include public health outcomes, the number of identified adulterations, the number of product recalls, or something entirely different. But the debaters couldn't decide which option was the best.
Despite the fact that we have yet to classify or rank proactive anti-food fraud approaches, progress is still being made. Prepare yourself for more acronyms, though. Dr. Everstein wrote that the Food Safety and Modernization Act, or FSMA, mandates that the FDA issue regulations to prevent intentional adulteration of food.
And the FDA made a tentative conclusion that food fraud would be most appropriately addressed in a rule called, quote, "Current good manufacturing practice and hazard analysis and risk-based preventive controls for human food," or the PC rule. Wow, that was a mouthful. Anyway, some businesses' compliance dates will be effective as early as September of 2016.
So what's the deal with the PC rule? Essentially, food fraud regulations are included within the rule that primarily address food safety threats, as opposed to a rule focused on intentional adulteration of food exclusively.
Food industry stakeholders may find it necessary to do more than what's mandated by the FDA, though, as food fraud can also be caused by new or unexpected adulterants or fraud practices, even ones that we aren't looking for or don't have the means to track.
And the FDA isn't alone, as multiple industry groups, such as the Global Food Safety Initiative, or GFSI, are currently pursuing food fraud counterplans. Specific guidance and recommendations tailored to these groups for reducing the risk of fraud are desperately needed, though.
And don't forget we have science on our side to help out. Analytical chemistry tests that identify components found in certain adulterating ingredients has helped to detect food fraud in the past.
Though the debaters were pretty insistent that these techniques be further developed to not only identify when there's a problem with the food's true identity, but they also want the test to say what specific adulterant is actually in the food. It sounds trivial, but some chemical compounds behave very similar to one another, and at present it can be difficult, if not impossible, to tell them apart.
Well, it's super clear that current detection methods have some shortcomings, or else we wouldn't be having this conversation.
And our listeners wouldn't have a podcast to look forward to this week.
You're both right. The debaters and author agree that current provisions are inadequate to handle food fraud as the food system continues to globalize. It was suggested that we need to develop an efficient, comprehensive, and holistic food fraud prevention strategy that utilizes a multidisciplinary approach.
That's a mouthful and awfully optimistic. Is it even possible to have a strategy, or anything for that matter, that is comprehensive, holistic, and multidisciplinary?
Well, the debaters seem to think so. The hope is that this new strategy for prevention and control of food fraud would take advantage of resources already in place among federal agencies, the food industry itself, and academic nonprofit organizations.
So it seems like we're all getting involved.
Yep, and Dr. Everstein lays out some of the groundwork for how this may play out. First, industry must lead the implementation of food fraud prevention and control strategies, since it already has primary visibility and oversight regarding supply chains.
Next, federal agencies must provide broad regulatory guidelines, fund the research needed to inform and develop food fraud prevention and control methodologies, and foster information sharing among stakeholders in government, industry, and academia.
Then, academic researchers must form teams spanning multiple disciplines in order to develop and test food fraud vulnerability and the risk assessment methodologies. Academic or nonprofit institutions may also serve as facilitators for information sharing between the federal agencies and the food industry.
And again, that was the strategy delineated by Dr. Everstein herself. The debaters improved upon this outline by suggesting the creation of an organizing body or group that can champion the prevention of food fraud.
But what would this organizing body look like? Who would be responsible for creating and regulating it?
Well, not all the kinks were worked out during the two-day program, but the debaters thought the organization could be modeled after Information Sharing Analysis Centers, or ISACs, which are put in place to help the private sector and government reach agreements regarding regulations and requirements. The hope is that these venues would promote discussions between private industry stakeholders and government regulators.
The debaters also stressed that food vulnerability assessments were an essential component of food supply safety, and that these could account for relationships among producers, suppliers, and distributors. They also see public health specialists, epidemiologists, analytical chemists, lawyers, economists, and procurement specialists as especially vital players in this process.
Wait. How would economists help to fight against food fraud? I don't quite see the connection there.
Well, the idea is that the proper use of economics and trade data within the food supply chain could help highlight specific problem areas where fraud could be in play, and potentially even provide early indications of fraudulent behavior.
After all, who better to add their two cents regarding economically motivated adulteration than the economists themselves?
That makes sense.
My question is about the actual testing of food itself. How are the debaters planning to find fraudulent components at the source?
The debaters wanted to change up this process by requiring non-targeted approaches that identify what constitutes a true product, rather than testing for likely contaminants.
So basically, instead of looking for what's wrong in a food, the tests are instead going to make sure a product doesn't deviate from its true characterization, thereby indicating adulteration, dilution, or contamination.
And I'm guessing this product testing would have to take place at pretty strategic points within the supply chain.
Yep, and these are determined by risk assessments and vulnerability analysis.
Oh, and let's not forget that those who commit food fraud are considered criminals, and that there are, in fact, repercussions for such actions.
Rather than increasing these punishments, though, the debaters thought it might be better to focus on enforcing current regulations and to put more energy into ensuring that guilty parties are actually held accountable for their actions.
Seems pretty well thought out, but what about funding?
As far as money goes for these projects, Dr. Everstein writes that these programs must be federally funded.
And the debaters added that funding could derive from federal agencies like the Department of Health Services, or the DHA, as well as the FDA and USDA.
Overall, one of the biggest take-home messages here is that current information-sharing practices are woefully inadequate, and that U.S. policy must increase exchanges between government regulators and industry in regards to food fraud.
So, I guess as consumers, we're pretty hands-off on this issue?
Not at all, actually. The debaters stress that this isn't just work for the professionals, but that consumers can play a vital role in food fraud prevention.
Are you feeling lied to by your food labels and down about your lack of control to enact change? Then yell about it. Don't take no for an answer. According to our debaters, these concerns should be heard and addressed by regulations.
Apparently, fancy, innovative social media interfaces are underway in order to achieve such goals. But for now, you have our Twitter and Facebook accounts to rant to.
We want to hear your food fraud concerns and thoughts on today's podcast. Tweet us at ISGPForum with hashtag ISGPForum, or check out the Facebook page by searching ISGP's The Forum.
Thanks for socializing with science today, and we'll see you next time right here on The Forum.
The Institute on Science for Global Policy, or ISGP, is a nonprofit organization that convenes international meetings bringing together scientists, policymakers, industry leaders, students, and other stakeholders to discuss pertinent scientific issues facing society. The ISGP has no opinions and does not lobby. Therefore, the preceding podcast reflects the views expressed by the presenters and debaters at our conference. For more information, please visit our website at www.scienceforglobalpolicy.org. Thank you.